podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Thanks for downloading another episode of Scrum Again by The Attacking Scrum. This is our trawl back through the archives where we bring you some of our favourite interviews and episodes from the last 6 years while we're off having our summer break. We are back, however, with some specials around the Wales-South Africa series. And that will be back next week with, a regular episode on Monday the 4th of July, so make sure you stay tuned for that one. If you're not subscribed to The Attacking Scrum already, make sure you do that, then you get a notification every time that we have a new podcast available for you to listen to. Also, if you're enjoying these, then please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. That would be really, really helpful. And as I say, we're looking forward to getting back to talking about some rugby on the pitch. But in the meantime, to keep you in the mood, we thought we'd bring you our interview with Sam Warburton from a couple of years ago. This was just prior to the 2019 World Cup. So again, feels like a lifetime ago, really. But it was really great to meet him. One of those occasions where they say don't meet your heroes, but it turned out to be just the opposite. Complete, absolute gent. Had loads of time for us and was, you know, really nice to get him on the record and opening up. So this was just before or just after his autobiography came out. So there's a lot of chat about that, which actually is well worth a read if you've not done so already. It's not your average standard up and down sports autobiography. So yeah, get stuck into that if you haven't done so already. And finally, a couple of thanks to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. If you want to get some great quality coffee, you can do that over at socoffeetrades.co.uk. Right, enjoy the episode.
Finds Lee Byrne and he finds space, and outside is James Hook. And he too with his support. It's great to try, surely, for Wales. Warburton under the post.
George North. For the 22, offloads to his skipper, and Sam Warburton pins his ears back and slides in.
Dual Lions captain, Wales skipper, Cardiff Blues flanker, and now I'm delighted to say attacking scrum guest Sam Warburton. Sam, welcome to the show. How are you?
Very good, thanks. How are you?
Yes, it's fantastic to have you on here to chat about your new book, which we're really excited to get stuck into. Really thoroughly enjoyed reading that. And of course, plenty of other things to talk about with the Rugby World Cup on the horizon as well. Let's start with the book, though. The book is called Open Side, and it certainly catches you in an open and honest mood. Was that the intention when you set out to write the book?
It was always my intention. I'm not sure whether the publishers, HarperCollins, thought it was going to perhaps be that open and honest. And obviously, being open side, flanker, that's why it was called open side. But originally it was, I think the plan was to call it something like too big, too fast, too strong. Mm. Not necessarily me, just the game, about the collision sport and where it's going. But I think once then they started getting the text back and seeing probably how honest I was chatting about my career, because I guess people think, they see rugby players, you know, big alpha male, don't feel pressure, don't feel nerves, impenetrable, you know, don't show emotion and that. Then when I was actually talking about how I perceive my career, like the ups and downs, then I thought, well, this is probably a bit more open and honest than we'd thought, which is where the name change to Open Side came in, which I thought was really fitting, so that's why it's called Open Side. But yeah, perhaps a little bit more honest. I don't mind about showing perhaps the more vulnerable side to myself throughout my career, because I played like probably, you know, really hostile physical style, but you know, I found it, not all the time, but you know, parts of my career I found it psychologically, you know, very hard to play, so, and physically, which is where obviously the collision side of it comes into. So yeah, no, it covers a few bases.
Perhaps, you know, you talk about the, I suppose, yeah, the, you know, not being afraid to show some vulnerability there. Perhaps there's no bit more, I guess, where that's more at show than when you're talking about being on the eve of the second Lions test. Maybe just talk us through, you know, without spoiling the book, kind of what was going through your mind at that stage?
Oh, God. So when you're, like, playing for the Lions, obviously the pinnacle, like, and it's all I ever wanted to do, and fans outside will look and be like, oh, these boys are living the dream. And you are, like, I know you are, and it's an amazing privilege to get there. But when you're there, you can't help but maybe I was putting more pressure on myself than other players. I'm so desperate, so desperate to win that test series and to be like a victorious team. But like that eve of that test, like I was strapped. That game, I was strapped up with like 8 body parts, both ankles, both knees, both shoulders, my hip, my elbow. I was just hanging on by a thread that tour, and I just wanted to be able to deliver. And I was worried I couldn't from a physical point of view. I was coming back from injury, so I didn't start the first test. So I was starting this game, so the pressure to play well, starting as a captain, was enormous. And all these things, I remember just on the phone to my mum, and I was like, I was never going to do it, but I just felt, if I could just escape this just for 24 hours and just jump on a plane back home, I would, you know? And probably wouldn't have if it actually really happened, but that's just how I felt, like it was all just snowballing. But when you then go through the game and you come out the other side, well, then it's completely worth all the negative stuff that you go through. You just got to kind of like just see it through, really. But yeah, I think people might see Lions tours, think that we're, you know, out on jet skis and having fun and having a laugh, like on the DVD, how that portrays. Then we play a game on the weekend, then we go out and have a few more drinks again. I'm like, that's really far from what a Lions tour is actually about. Lots of travelling, lots of pressure, lots of training, injury management, commercial and sponsorship opportunities, press, like all day, every day. I remember it wasn't until about week 5 we actually had a full day off with nothing. We could wake up in our beds that day and we could go back to sleep and have nothing. It was like 5 weeks, you know, and especially as me as captain, having all the other responsibilities you've got to do. So obviously over the course of time, that just snowballs, and it bottlenecked, you know, in that evening for that second test.
And the book has a theme of leadership running throughout it. Obviously, you touched on some of that there. Why is it that you kind of chose to concentrate on that rather than just being, I guess, a bit more of a, like, you know, the previous books were up and down, you know, rugby tales, really?
Yeah, I think this has been much more enjoyable because, like, I've managed to go, like, delve deeper into the sort of, like, sort of talk about the mental side of the sport. Then the leadership, like, lessons I've learned as well, because I went into a leadership role at 22, like, not wanting to do it. Nowhere near the best captain at that moment in time as well, and I had to learn quickly how to do it, and I changed my style, but I learned, you know, how to adapt like to certain situations along the way. Like, I compare myself as a captain when I was 27, 28 when I finished, compared to 22. Worlds apart. I was so much better towards the end of my career. But so I talk about the leadership lessons I learned along the way, my principles of leadership, which I applied in my career, which hopefully can, you know, not just be relatable to rugby players and captains, but to any sport or business leader or whoever. You know, so I hope there's lessons for everyone to learn there as well.
Yeah, it definitely comes across. And, you know, you've spoken about captaincy and I guess a tricky relationship you had with it. You said, you know, at the start of your career, you hated captaining sides.
Yeah.
How did that relationship change over the years?
Oh, it's a strong word, but I did hate it. Yeah. But you do it because it's such a privilege. You almost feel like embarrassed and like shameful if I was willing to turn down being captain for Wales or the Lions. You can't ever turn that down. But first Lions tour, didn't want to do it, but you do it because you have to. Like, Lions captain, like, geez, how many times is anyone Lions captain? Like, you've got to do it. But then in that tour there was, you know, Paul O'Connell and Brian O'Driscoll, and I was thinking, like, surely those guys are better contenders. So I didn't really believe myself. As a player I always did, but not as a captain I didn't. But then in 17, I was completely different for New Zealand. I remember, even though I wasn't Wales captain at that moment in time, because I dropped the captaincy because I thought I just needed to focus on my form, I just need to nail the Six Nations. And fortunately, I did probably have one of my better Six Nations campaigns I've ever had. Then I was very comfortable to take that captaincy role because I knew I was playing well. So then I remember I was thinking, like, about Warren Gatland. I was like, oh, please ring me because I'm the best guy to lead this team to beat New Zealand, because I was just like, I felt it was my calling, like, to beat New Zealand, you know, for the Lions and help that team do that. You know, I was desperate to do it. So completely changed, like, psychologically as a captain from younger to older. And I guess the book kind of leads you through that a little bit, you know, and how I changed throughout the years with that.
Do you miss it, captaincy?
No. No. I mean, like, so I sort of said, which sounds quite strong, I didn't enjoy 80% of my career, I enjoyed only 20%. People might be like, well, that's very ungrateful. But I'm like, no, because the 20% I enjoyed outweighs the 80% I didn't enjoy tenfold, you know. But the 80% you don't enjoy, who enjoys going on internal flights every 2-3 days, travelling around the country all the time, or doing constant sponsorship and commercial things, or constantly speaking to media and press, or going on the physio bed and having operations and injections and having blood drawn out of you and getting rid of inflammation and having MRI scans, like, and then the stress it puts your family through, and then not being able to walk the dog because everybody wants to stop you and ask you why you lost on the weekend. Like, they're all the things that people don't see. So yeah, being a rugby player and playing 80 minutes was incredible. I loved 100% of that. I wasn't ever nervous 1 minute, from minute one to minute 80. I loved that. I was never nervous because that was like that's your comfort zone almost. But you're out your comfort zone, all the anxiety beforehand and then dealing with the aftermath of your game and all those things I mentioned. That's the bits you don't enjoy. But that's actually the majority of being a player, you know. So playing, the privilege of playing for the Lions or for your national team on your stadium, in front of 75,000 happens, 10 times a year? Not even 1% of the time. So that's what I meant when I say that. So when I explain it, I think people understand a bit more. But the start with it sounds quite drastic.
I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of sacrifice that you mentioned within the book as well, and a lot about mentality, and you know whether that's I've raised a little smile in when it talks about 2011. You said you turned down a slice of your own birthday cake because it was a couple of days before the Ireland quarterfinal. Yeah. Now, like you said, the reality is that that's probably not going to make a difference during the game, but mentally to you it did.
Yeah, so I remember it was lovely. The squad brought out the happy birthday thing, cake, all sang happy birthday. I was like, oh, thanks. Yeah, cut it all up and didn't have a piece. I remember I was in a room with Luke Charteris going, as I got older, I realised, right, I can have a biscuit and a slice of cake and it's not going to affect my performance, you know. If anything, you need to bang in some calories pre-match because you need the energy, and particularly post-match, you know, you expend like, I'm guessing, I have no idea, 4,000 calories in the game maybe, a match day. You can eat kind of guilt-free after a game, you know. But I was in my room on a Thursday before a game on a Saturday for Wales, and I was having a cup of tea with Dan Lidgett and Luke Charteris. I was room with Dan, and Luke popped in for a chat, as you do in the evening. So we made a cup of tea, and he started dipping a shortbread into his cup of tea 48 hours from a game. And I wasn't even trying to be funny. And I remember saying, what are you doing? And he said, what, you're going to eat that now before a game? And he sort of looked at the biscuit, looked at me like, but at the time I thought it was normal, what are you on about type thing. But I was so strict on myself about what I ate and how I prepared. I always sort of prided myself on being the best professional I could be. As I got older, I learned to relax a bit, and I would have a biscuit 2 days from a game. But yeah, I was very sort of, from a professional point of view, my mindset, I was very strict on myself because it just gave me every single possible edge I could get, you know. But that's just what I was like preparing for the game.
And it's obviously very meticulous when it comes to your own training and preparation, and from what I can gather from the book and having heard you speak before, you wanted that to rub off on the squad, and it seemed kind of really evident in both those World Cup campaigns and on the Lions that you were kind of a lead by example captain and you wanted people to follow that lead. Was that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it is, so you know, I just wanted to be the best professional I could be off the field, and then I wanted to be the most fierce competitor on the field. So that was kind of like how I saw myself as like a leader. And then the captaincy, you obviously have to teach yourself and learn how to communicate with referees. You know, you've got to get used to speaking in front of the group, you know, regularly as a captain, and learning the tactics, and not learning the tactics, you all know tactics, but like there'll be front rows and front fives who don't understand kicking strategy. Where if you're captain, you've got to understand the kicking strategy wherever you are in the field, you know, which starter plays we're going to use in which areas of the field, which are things that your number 10s know, but you as a number, I was number 7, me as a captain, you have to know that. And there's only a few players on the pitch who need to know that level of detail, which might be your number 10s, your captain if he's not a line-out caller, and then your line-out caller, because your line-out caller needs to call ball, which is going to suit the starter play that your 10's calling. So that's why you'll always see a quick conversation, or when I was playing anyway, it might be like myself, Alan Wynne-Jones and Dan Bigger, have a quick chat, because Dan will say the starter play he wants to use, Alan Wynne will think about which line-outs will suit that, and you can call your line-out accordingly, and then as captain you've got to oversee those things. So, but these are things which a captain has to do. Well, if you're not a captain and you're just a number 6 or a front rower or a wing or a centre, you can just focus on your individual role in that starter play. But when you've got a captaincy role, you've got to like oversee all these things all game, all the time, as well as speaking to the ref. So that's how captaincy can kind of distract performance a little bit, and why there was times I wanted to take it away from myself, because then I just wanted to be the young teenage boy that I used to be, where I just wanted to go out and just be as fierce as possible and just cause collisions and just like tackle and be aggressive, you know, because that's my game. there was times I wanted the captaincy stripped from me so I could just be that and go back into that little world again, which I love. But yeah, they're all the things I guess that I explain about captaincy.
We've touched on 2011, which obviously during that Rugby World Cup you led Wales to World Cup semi-final. Now anyone listening to this will know what happened. There's some amazing highs and some some incredible lows during that tournament. Looking back at it, are you able to kind of enjoy those highs and look at the great win over Ireland, for example, rather than just thinking about the semi-final heartache?
So my parents got that semi-final shirt. I remember at the end of that World Cup, we had like a big squad signing session. So like we'd say, right guys, like 10 items per player. We've got a massive room in the team hotel set out. Like there was literally like, I must have been 30 big circular dinner tables, you can imagine. And we just put a kit out and we went down on an afternoon off and we just, like, everyone was there for hours just signing everyone's kit so you can take it back home to family, friends, charity, whatever. I remember thinking this shirt is probably going to be worth signing for the squad. So I remember I took my shirt down as one of my items. I put it down and everyone signed it nicely. So I went home and I gave it to my parents, you know. I was like, oh, like, it was a semi-final shirt. So they've got it up in their front room, but they're like, oh, do you mind if you put the picture of you and Vincent Clerc in there? So I was like, well, no, because... when I come home, that's a shirt I led Wales to a semi-final in, not the shirt I got sent off in. That's how I perceive it, you know. But then now I'm retired, I wouldn't mind if that picture was up there now, because when I'm playing, I don't want to revisit those emotions, you know, when I was playing and be reminded about that. But now I can see, well, it was one of the defining moments of my career, and I wouldn't change it because, not that I wanted to get sent off, but I think the success that we had the 2 years after that, from winning a Grand Slam, then winning another Six Nations the year after, then having 14 Welsh guys on the Lions tour and playing a test to beat Australia. Had that red card happened, you know, I don't know whether we would have had the 2 years after. Like, sometimes you've got to go through a bit of adversity to come to the other end, and it might have helped shape that team. So I've always been a believer things happen for a reason, which is why I wouldn't change that red card. So now if they wanted to put that red card in, now I'm retired, I don't mind seeing it now. I know it was probably quite a point in my career, and I probably developed as a person massively from that. From one moment happened in my career, that would probably be the one. So I'm not ashamed of it. I was probably a bit embarrassed of it when I was playing, but now I've learned not to be, really.
Because you talk about owning your mistakes in the book, and you know, whether you agree it was a red card or not, like you say, you didn't mean to get sent off. Was that, how difficult a process was that to go through?
It was difficult. I kind of say like a story about everything I went through after that. Then just which obviously we haven't got time to do, but to sum it up, what really put it to bed for me was, it was 6 weeks later, and I sort of explained on this, but 6 weeks later I was doing another BBC interview. So like, I mean, everyone was doing interviews from all over the country, coming down to the Blues training ground to speak to me on press afternoons and that, all wanting to know one thing about the red card. And then they asked me one thing about the red card again like 6 weeks later, but that morning my granddad passed away, and they probably wanted some really emotive answer about how devastating the red card was and how many people I might have let down and stuff. But I just said that my granddad passed away this morning, and it finally made me realise that there's much more important things to worry about than the game of rugby. And that's what put it to bed. And then from then I was like, I just moved on. Because you think, when you're young and you're young 20s, you're breaking through as a pro, and you don't have, perhaps you don't have a partner, you don't have a girlfriend, whatever, you're probably living at home with a family, so you're not worrying about mortgages and bills and all that, all these real things that people have to worry about in life. All you're worrying about, you might not be studying, all you're focused on is rugby, and you think it's your life and it's the be all and end all, and that like it's all you're about, it's all anyone is thinking about you. But really, like, there's so much more going on in life than that. And until you go through a little bit of hardship, really, to take yourself out of your little bubble and actually gain some perspective over the real world, you know, that's when you realise, oh, what I'm going through is actually not as bad as it seems, you know. So that moment really put that red card to bed for me.
And fast forward 4 years into Rugby World Cup 2015, led the side into that World Cup again, including a titanic game at Twickenham. Something I've always wanted to ask you.
You brought it up, not me.
what did Mike Brown say to you as you screwed up?
Dan Lydiot put in that huge hit on Tom Woods, you know, which people remember. It was like that, you see those NFL games where like somebody spins around 180 degrees, you think, how is that ever going to happen? And that's what happened with Dan. And I can, right, if I was on the England team, I would have been angry. Of course I would. But I was on the Welsh team, so I was really happy because, you know, we, you know, asserted our authority. And when you're away from home, and a team's going to try and like physically intimidate you, when an opportunity comes where you've got to stand up for yourself, you've got to do it as a 15. And just like all these little psychological wins, England needed to know that we weren't there to mess around, you know. And not that I ever wanted Dan to put in a dangerous tackle, but I'm always going to back up my players. If it was dangerous and he put a shot into the head of someone, I'd be saying, mate, that's stupid and you cost us. But like, in my eyes, he just went, he hit him so hard, and he did try and rap, and I've been tackled by Dan, so I know. I've seen players in the tunnel go up to him pre-match and say, please don't hit me in my knees like you have been on other players, because they're concerned for their health, you know. Like, he was a feared tackler, defensive player. So he just launched himself into Tom Wood, and just the angle it was, he tried to rap him. And Dan, if you know Dan, he's not a malicious guy. Unbelievably fierce competitor, but he's not a nasty guy. Which is why I backed him. So we all went in, and when I rush into those situations when everyone's getting on top of each other, I'm actually, the first time I'm shouting is actually no penalties, because I don't want anything to be reversed or give away 3 points. So I'm not in there giving it the big one. I'm not a fighter, I'm not that sort of, and you, what can you do this day and age now, I'm telling you? Like, you can't do anything in a game, it's all handbags. So I'm just saying to anyone, just like, discipline, no penalties, don't want to reverse this, don't want to give away 2-3 points. I think we got another scrum for me, I can't remember, but. And then I was just getting tugged on the back of my neck, which I always ignore as it happens. But I got tugged 3 times properly. So I just turned around to be like, who the hell is it? I'm the pacifist here. I'm trying to calm things down. And then it was Mike Brown. And I was just asking him politely, like, what on earth are you doing? Like, I'm just really trying to, like, sort things out here. And you're just adding fuel to the fire. But, yeah, you know, I mean, it went viral back over Wales. But I'm just thinking... And he knows this himself, like, you know, when you're playing games and you're behind your forward pack, it's very easy to be brave, you know?
Yeah.
Just something along those lines.
And winning that game with, you know, with half the back line injured, there was massive injuries going into it. I was at that game in Cardiff before the tournament when Webb and Halfpenny got injured.
Yeah.
And then during that one game, to have all of those injuries happen almost at the same time, how much of a test of your leadership was that at that point? You know, was that sense of belief always there that you could go on and win this game?
I think that's what Wales have, like, we've always, I think Gatland has instilled in us, is that resilience. The injuries were a joke. And had we had won, so that England game, obviously, we were littered with injuries. I don't know how, like, looking back, I'm like, we should never have won that game. England's home record in Twickenham is incredible anyway. They got a great home ratio, win ratio. Never mind the added emotion that it's a home World Cup game. I look at the injury, like, how did we, like, at the time I didn't appreciate it because it was just one more step on the ladder that we had to complete just to get to a World Cup final. So it's only in hindsight I look back and I'm thinking, geez, that's probably one of Wales' biggest ever victories. In the history of Wales rugby, like, it was a momentous occasion, but at the time... So say like 2013 when we beat England 30-3, we can enjoy that. It's the finale, it's the end of a tournament, you can have a drink and enjoy it, we won something. But this was just another group game, so we had to get ready for Australia within 6-7 days. So you can't really, you can enjoy it, but you have to move on from it pretty quick, you know. So I didn't enjoy it perhaps like I should have, but now I look back, I have no idea how, like, we got through that game given the circumstances. And I kind of talk in the book, really, was the sleep deprivation, because I don't know if you might remember, it was in the news, but I was in the room with Dan and he was adamant we had a ghost in our room, and I can't go into that. So I didn't sleep for 2 days. So added all together, I literally have no idea how we won that game.
And, you know, again, a lot of the, as I said throughout this, kind of so much of the book is about mentality and getting those wins in massive games. I suppose Wales, in during your tenure as captain, the question mark was always over beating the Southern Hemisphere sides, and a lot of the press were kind of always quick to say that that was down to a mentality and a sense of belief. Was that fair criticism, or, you know, were they down the wrong lines at those points?
Maybe. So I always said, I was quite honest, I remember when I was playing and we hadn't beaten Australia for like 10 games or something, and then, like, is it a psychological thing? I'm like, well, no, because we've beaten England, we've beaten France, and, like, we had a good running in South Africa. We've beat South Africa like 4 times now, you know, in the last five, so since 14, the last 5 years. So we've seen teams who can beat Australia that we can beat on many occasions. So the psychologically, I don't think that's it. I was like, they've just been better than us. Like, I don't think you're unlucky 13 times in a row, 12 times in a row. They were obviously just that little bit better. There were some games which were desperate how we lost, and, like, oh, they were horrendous losses to have. last minute penalties, last minute, last second tries, but they were obviously just that little bit better. But I do admit, I never had a belief problem. But you don't know for sure what's going through players' minds, so that's why I think the lines are different to Wales, perhaps. Maybe for Wales, out of the 23, maybe I know when I look at Alan Wynn and Toby Faletau and Jamie Roberts and John Davis and George North and the Halfpenny and Adam Jones, getting Jenkins, I know they believe they can beat anyone in the world. But can I say that about the whole 23? Like, I don't actually know. Like, maybe those doubts might creep into a younger, more impressionable person's head. But for the Lions, when you're in New Zealand, you've got 23 of the most competitive animals in the British and Irish Isles, all in one changing room. Every one of those guys genuinely believes, wants to, and just expects to beat New Zealand. With, you know, the psychology is a lot different when you've got all those guys in one room, which is why I think the Lions did so well. But can I say that on behalf of the whole Welsh team? Like, I can't say yes or no. I don't know. And maybe that was a reason. But I think that was combined with the fact that we obviously weren't quite good enough on those days as well.
And kind of, you know, you mentioned a lot of those leaders in there now. Some of them still playing, some of them retired. And on paper, you know, looks a squad, even right now, full of leaders. You know, you add Dan Bigger and Ken Owens into that list. Are there any kind of emerging players that you've seen, either through punditry work or, you know, connection with the Blues, that are going to be the, you know, the future leaders of Wales, the ones who are going to be doing that real strong leadership job and driving the team forward?
I think a player who's been great in the Northern Hemisphere, and if you've been watching Six Nations and Autumn Internationals, you know about him. Josh Navidi has been brilliant for Wales, and he's been brilliant for the Blues for about like 6-7 years, but for ages. But Wales, we've had sevens coming off conveyor belts, yeah. So he's obviously had to wait his time to have an opportunity, but he's been playing, and he's been brilliant for Wales. I think this World Cup could be a real platform to him to announce himself. I've sort of said before, I think someone like Tom Curry is going to be that kind of player who's going to play for England and really announce himself as like a world-class back rower. Sam Hunderhill is similar. They've got those abilities. But you need... like, those boys have already played well in Six Nations and already played well in Autumn Games. But when you do it on the world stage at World Cups or Lions Tours, that's when you catapult yourself into genuine world-class status, you know. So I reckon those boys can do that this World Cup.
How aware are you of that? That step up in intensity when you're on those. I mean, obviously you mentioned a bit about the Lions tour there, but you know, when you went to 2011 as a 22-year-old, how aware were you of the magnitude of what was happening?
So like, being in New Zealand is, if anything's better, like 2011, all the pressure was on New Zealand because they hadn't won a World Cup since
87.
Yeah, 87. So like, the pressure on them was incredible. So they were always called the bottlers and everything. So we went in under the radar. So for us, like, we had no, like, your Twitter feed's a bit busier than normal. And back then, 2011, I think I was a kiddie when I hit 5,000 followers. Like, you know, I was like, you know, social media was nothing compared to what it is now. So like, your social media feed might be a little bit busier than normal, but like, nothing really. You don't get what's going on at home. Which is why then in 15 I realised, because it was like a home World Cup. We played a couple of group games in Principality and a couple in Twickenham and stuff. And that was then enormous. So I think Japan seems like that now. It seems like there's, like, with the world nowadays, everything's so much more accessible with social media and press and all that. I think boys will go out there now, some of the younger guys who've had, this will be their first big tournament, World Cup of Lions, and they'll go out there. And dealing with that, as opposed to being in, say, if you're an English player, being in Penny Hill Park, you know, with your normal food, normal training regime, you can pop home, you know, stuff like that. When you're away in Japan and then you've got all this pressure and all this hype around you, and then you can still deliver, you know, that's the different sort of psychological challenges that you have, you know, in World Cups. So when players can rock up and play at home, yeah, great, well done. But it's going away from home, out of your comfort zone, and playing up and rocking up, you know, that's when I think you get your genuine world-class status.
And heading into this World Cup, very different role for you, you know, your new career as a pundit. How, you know, do you kind of apply that same kind of professional, ultra-professionalism that you had as a player? Do you do the same thing with punditry? You know, you're watching games twice over and memorising the Russian back row forwards' names and all these kind of things.
Yeah, I want to make sure that I can be quite insightful. Yeah. So I make sure, like, say you get given loads of stats, and out of the stats, I might not think 90% are relevant, but 10%, I read them all because 10% of them will be good. I think, oh, actually, that is specific, and I might drop it in somewhere if it's necessary. But yeah, I make sure I watch my games. I want people to watch to... I always see it as like an education type, coach type thing, where I want to actually, if someone can listen to me and hear something I say about a driving line out or a kick chase or a breakdown, and they think, oh, I didn't realise that, and they learn something, which, or they might be like take it back to their team and coach them that, or somebody might be going, oh, I didn't realise that's why they did that, then that's like a win for me. So I kind of see it as that sort of role. So I want to be able to like educate people on rugby's complicated game. Like, it is complicated. I want people to understand why we do that. So many times people say, oh, we kick too much. I'm like, who's the best team in the world? And they say New Zealand. I'm like, yeah, they kick the most out of anyone in world rugby because there's a strategy behind kicking. So as an example, so yeah, I quite like explaining all these things. So I like the challenge of it. The only difference is I still consider myself like a good professional doing it. It's like, I wouldn't ever just want to just turn up and just blag a game and talk about it, you know. But the only difference is I'll just eat my body weight in chocolate while doing it, which is lovely. So I don't have to be so strict on my diet. So it's nice. I can eat a nice, I can have a nice bag of minstrels, bit of Haribo, hot chocolate and that. When you're back on air, just clear the table, put it back by your feet. And then when you're off air again, I can pick them all back up again. That's the only difference.
Because, you know, given how intense your career was, you'd be, you know, you could be forgiven for going, actually, do you know what, I want to leave rugby behind now and go and do something different. Was that ever an option, or did you think, no, you know, I want to stay in this game and experience a different side of it?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because that's actually exactly how I felt. I remember thinking, oh, I just want to get away from this game. Like, it's just, I remember when I used to play, I was like, I could never coach. Like, but then when you're playing, it's because when you're playing, you want to get away from it on your days off. I never would have wanted to analyse any more than I had to. But then, so when I finished, I had about 2 or 3 months, I did nothing involved with the game. I knew I was always going to do something, but for 2 or 3 months, I enjoyed doing nothing. It was really nice getting away from the game of rugby. But as the longer I'm away from it, the more I'm actually like, you realise how much you love the game, and you realise why you got there in the first place. And I feel like, well, I can give back. Like, there's so much I know. I feel like I'm only scratching the surface when I talk to people about like rugby. I want to be able to like go to a young back rower and just give him everything that's in my brain, so he's got that from the age of 20, 21. So yeah, the longer I'm out, the more involved I actually feel like getting. But initially, straight after my retirement, I was enjoying like time with the family and away from the game. But now, naturally, everything I'm doing, I'm just gravitating closer and closer back to the game, which is great.
Sam, it's been amazing to speak to you. Thank you. Thanks for opening up with us. And we'll hopefully get you back on the attacking scrum at some point in the future as well.
No, thanks for having me on. Great to chat to you. Thanks. Cheers.
Podcast Network.